today's episode.
If you're not going to be using it yourself, make sure that you have a market in which to sell it before you take the dive into it.
Typically, you might budget for sort of 5 or 6 tons a hectare of hemp.
From a farmer's perspective, the biggest thing is it's a new crop. It's not a new crop because it was grown between 1926 and 1972 or 74.
Welcome to Cropcast. I am Tiffany Stevenson, and today we're going to be talking about alternative crops. We have 3 guest speakers on today: Donald Dunbar talking about rye, Mark Boucher-Gibbs talking about hemp, and Ian Riddle talking about sugar beet. If you listen through until the end, you'll hear an update from just now out in the field. First up, we're talking to Donald about rye. Donald, would you like to start by introducing yourself?
Hi, Tiffany. Donald Dunbar. I am a consultant, senior consultant in the Southeast region for SEC Consulting. And goodness me, I've been with SEC Consulting for 26 years.
So a lot of farmers have been talking about growing rye, and I'm seeing more and more fields of rye being grown now. What are they growing rye for, and what are the markets available for the crop?
Yeah, so it's a crop that we have started to see reappear in Scotland. I remember many years ago that rye was being grown for an early bite or silage crop. But the advent of hybrid rye was the big change, the breakthrough moment. And it was picked up as a crop by the anaerobic digesters that were producing biogas. It produces a big yield. It has a high gas yield. And so I think from that, people started to see it growing in fields, and it ignited the interest in other people, other growers. And from that, I have now seen dairy farmers grow rye, hybrid rye, and some farmers looking for an alternative in their rotation have started to grow hybrid rye as well.
So what are the advantages of growing hybrid rye?
It starts to grow early in the season. It is vigorous in its growth. And because it starts to grow earlier in the season, it's ready to harvest earlier. And it produces a big biomass yield. So that is attractive to the biogas plant. It may also be the thing that's attractive to the dairy farmer, because what it doesn't produce is a high quality yield. You can't compare it with growing grass to put in the silage pit. But those large dairy farms have been using it to provide a lower quality fodder to that they maybe mix with their high quality silage, or it's part of the base ration for the dry cows. Because it's harvested earlier, it means that they can then do something else with that field for the rest of the growing season. That may be reseeding it into grass. It may be to then put in another crop in as part of their rotation.
You're saying that it's harvested earlier. When would you be looking to harvest it?
You're harvesting before you would harvest wheat. It's probably more similar to winter oats in terms of its harvesting date. The hybrid rye also has a lower fertilizer requirement than the other cereal crops. It's less susceptible to some of the yield sapping diseases, although the caveat there is that it is prone to rust. But rust can be controlled using old chemistry at a lower price. So in terms of a gross margin, it actually is quite attractive. And what the comments I have had from people who are growing rye and taking it to a mature crop through the combine is that it is more reliable than a second wheat, as in its yield is consistent. You don't have a good year and then a bad year. And that it has lower growing cost because of the reduced inputs. It produces a huge volume of straw, and that is either a bonus, a benefit, or it potentially is, you know, is a bit of the downside, because you are a slower harvest speed because of that. You're probably typically half the speed that you'd be going if you were cutting wheat, and it's just because of that volume of straw. It's not hard to thresh. It's just you've got to bring that straw into the combine, get it through the drums and across the straw walkers.
So that's definitely one challenge of growing hybrid rye. What other challenges do farmers have to face when they're trying it out?
I think we cannot ignore the fact that it is a tall crop and it will grow over 6 foot in height. So the growth regulator to stop it going down is obviously essential. If you're growing it as a forage crop, you would put on two group plant growth regulators when they, you know, you're at that tillering early stem extension stage. If you are taking it through to being a grain crop, you would have a third one on to reduce that neck length. So trying to keep it around probably that, you know, 4 to 4 foot, 5 foot maybe. It's a bit like oats in that regard. You know, oats can be a tall crop, so there are similarities. So think about, you know, growing a crop of oats in terms of that growth regulator. The other downside is the potential for volunteers then emerging in other crops, and you're unable to control those volunteers. So you do need to think about where you are positioning it in the rotation.
You very nicely went and linked on to my next question there, Donald, of where would you try and place it in the rotation?
So we have growers around us in the borders who are putting rye in as an entry crop for oilseed rape instead of winter barley, because winter barley is quite an expensive crop to grow. It is a slightly later harvest than winter barley, but it has found a position there. And they have also put it in the position as a second wheat. And I guess if you're going to, you need to think about what you're going to follow that rye with. You might choose to grow a second rye, so then the volunteers aren't an issue. But it may be that you put it into a crop where you know that you can control them. So if you are going into some non-cereal crop, then you know the chances are you are going to be able to control the volunteers. Like if it was oilseed rape, you know, you're going in with a graminicide anyway.
There's definitely lots to think about when you're positioning the hybrid rye in the rotation. Are there any other key agronomic factors which growers need to be aware of?
I think they, generally speaking, are other good factors. It's more drought tolerant, and we've had a series of dry springs, and it hasn't held the rye back. It's pretty frost tolerant as well. It performs well across a range of different soil types. It probably does better than other cereals where it's in a light sandy, stony, maybe a low fertility soil, but it actually also does very well on more fertile soils. And speaking to some of the growers who have been taking it to a harvestable crop, you know, they're getting 10 tons a hectare consistently. So it's not a low yielding alternative to wheat. It's less prone to soil-borne root and stem diseases. It's not a break crop from wheat, but it is more tolerant to take all and other soil-borne diseases. Foliar disease-wise, I mentioned it is weak on rust, but it doesn't have the same, it doesn't suffer the same way from Septoria. It will get mildew potentially and some of the other diseases, but these aren't, you know, particularly yield sapping. I did mention it has a lower nitrogen requirement. So, you know, it's quite an attractive all round package there. One of the agronomic features about it is that because of that volume of straw, you're going to remove a lot of potash. So that just needs to be kept in mind. You need to keep your status up. It is a cross-pollinator. And because of that, there is a potential higher risk to having ergot appearing in the ear. But it, to be honest, it's not something that we've seen much of. And I did mention the volunteer thing. So, yeah, that I think that kind of covers some of the agronomics.
There's definitely a lot of plus points for Vi. And I think by the sounds of it, if people can deal with having to put a lot of growth regulators on to control the height and have a good slot in the rotation for it, just in case as volunteers, I feel like there's a lot of benefits to grow Vi.
I think there is. And it has that lower fertilizer requirement in terms of nitrogen. And that's because, again, it's a bit like oats. It is a nitrogen scavenger. It can extract that nitrogen from the soil. And so in that first year of growing, you might happily get away with 110 kilograms of nitrogen. You might need more if you're going to grow a second crop, or if the ground is, you know, already continually cropped for cereals and that natural residue of fertility is not there. From an MVZ point of view, the NMAX is 180 kilograms, but I haven't come across a grower who is applying that level of nitrogen to it in any circumstance. 150 for the people I've talked to is about as high as they go.
Very good. You mentioned that there's people growing it for biomass and people growing it for dairies. Have you heard of many people selling the grain? I don't know what the market's like for that.
So of the people I spoke to, it was an arable farmer with pigs, and he started growing rye 3 years ago. He uses his wheat and barley in his feed ration for the pigs, and he introduced the rye, and he saw an improvement in performance because of that rye. And that's to do with some of the amino acids that you find in the rye. So monogastrics, there's a benefit from it. He then got his neighbor to grow some, and his neighbor was impressed with the crop. Rather than just growing some for his neighboring pig producer, he's grown more, and he is selling that into the rye grain market. There's a demand for rye, or there's a market. I have to hesitate to say there's a demand, but there is a market for rye for milling, for distilling, and for feed.
So there's lots of different options that if you do grow rye, there's plenty of places that potentially it could go into.
Yeah, it's not an established crop in Scotland. It is growing and it's more a localized crop. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, right, this sounds quite good, if you're not going to be using it yourself, make sure that you have a market in which to sell it before you take the dive into it.
That's definitely great advice. Thanks, Donald. Is there some publications or videos that people can go and watch if they're interested in learning more about rye?
There is an article in the FAS website, and I'm sure you'll put the link in for that rather than me trying to tell you where it is. There's also a video that I did with a biogas plant where the manager of that plant was talking about why he uses rye and just your wider story about the biogas plant. In terms of varieties, AHDB have a recommended list for winter rye. The varieties are pretty much limited to two breeders and dominated by one. There's not huge differences, but I think if you're speaking to the merchant, you know, who sells seed, you will get their advice on whether it's a good one for the producing the forage crop for the bio plant and has been producing 50 tons a hectare of biomass, or if it's one that is better for taking through as a grain. And you know, straw height and standability might, you know, be the thing that separates what A from B.
We'll definitely put links in the show notes to these publications which Donald's talking about. Thank you, Donald.
Thank you.
Hello, Mark. Thank you very much for joining us today. Would you like to begin by introducing yourself?
Hi, Tiffany. I'm Mark Bash-Gibbs. I'm an agricultural consultant with SAC Consulting based in Edinburgh.
So today we're going to be talking about hemp. Hemp is something that I know I've not seen growing in Scotland. So would you like to begin by telling us, Mark, what hemp is grown for and what the markets are for the crop?
Yeah, sure. Hemp's an interesting one. Just by the virtue, I suppose, that it is a new crop. And I say a new crop, we're not actually growing it in any great volume here in Scotland. Of course, there's hemp for fibre and there's hemp for seed. And whilst there are a few pockets of growers growing hemp for seed and the derivative products, hemp for fibre in Scotland hasn't really taken off yet. And that's really because there's issues with the supply chain, and it's one thing growing the crop. Obviously, at the end of the day, you've got to have an end market, and you've got to be able to process the hemp fibre to add value and to put it into the supply chain. I think half the battle is sort of finding out what's going on out there and who's doing what, and we are, as a country, when I say a country, sort of the UK, quite a long way behind perhaps Europe. And we did grow hemp in Scotland back in the 19th century, and early 20th century, and it was used for ropes for shipping, and along came polypropylene, and sailing vessels were replaced by steam, and the hemp industry declined. If you look across the channel to France, they do grow a lot of hemp on the continent there. The EU as a whole grows a fair bit of hemp and has a much more integrated and developed supply chain. At the moment, there's about 1,000 hectares of hemp grown in the UK, predominantly in England. And the interest, I suppose, comes from the possibility of introducing a new crop into the rotation.
So do you think hemp could potentially be a growing market, that there could gradually be an increase in what could be grown because of the supply chain, or do you think it's quite limited?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think that's a question a lot of people are asking. And actually, if you have a look not too far afield, we've got the Hemp 30 project running, which is a project that's led by the University of York with a number of different associated companies contributing to it, which is looking to increase the hemp hectareage grown in the UK to some 80,000 hectares by 2030. Now, they wouldn't be doing that unless they thought there was potential for the crop to be introduced into rotations and for farmers to grow it. I think it's important to point out that, yes, there are some wonderful attributes that hemp can bring to a farmer's rotation. one of those is carbon capture, but the other is the ability to grow a crop with relatively very little inputs. But as I say, at the end of the day, that hemp crop that's harvested in September or October has to be decorticated. And by decorticating, we mean separating out the fiber element of the hemp from the pith, the middle, which we call the shiv. And it's those hemp fibers that can then be processed into all the various materials that it's currently being used, ranging from hempcrete, sort of building materials, insulation, and that's before you consider the sort of biomedicinal and car component uses and the various other uses that hemp's been put to.
So it does sound like there's a lot more work in processing the hemp. So now I can understand a bit more why there's some supply chain issues, because they need to be able to process it, which sounds a lot more difficult than if they're just processing wheat or barley and just take the combine through and it splits up the grain from the straw.
No, that's right. Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, the decortication process is a physical process, a mechanical process, and it requires a considerable investment in a decortication line. The hemps are baled off the field in square or round bales and stored on farm or centrally, and eventually it would be conveyed and transported to a decortication plant where it's physically put through the machine, and you end up with about 30% of the crop coming out the other end as fiber, about 60% as shiv, and about 10% as dust. And there are various markets that those various products can go into, as well as the fiber. So in a way, it's there's investment needed there. It strikes me that potentially there's opportunity for sort of cooperative, a cooperative organization to get together, group of growers that look to invest in the decortication plant, such that they have an end product that they can then supply into the supply chain.
So you mentioned before that there was carbon capture from hemp. What are the other advantages to a farmer to grow hemp?
Well, hemp can be grown year after year. I mean, that's one benefit. And for those farmers that aren't particularly engaged in farming, I would imagine it's a good crop because, you know, if it can be grown continuously on relatively low input requirements, it doesn't require a lot of management. In terms of establishing the crop, it goes in fairly late, probably end of April, beginning of May. If you've got black grass on the farm, for example, it gives you a good opportunity to clean up the fields before hemp goes in. In good conditions, and in ideal conditions, it will give ground cover very quickly, so much so that it outcompetes weeds. There's no known disease issue. It has a what we call a phytoremediation effect, such that it can potentially clean soils that are perhaps have heavy metals or contaminants. So the crop's in and it's away. It's in the ground until, as I say, August, September time. Once it's ready to harvest, it doesn't really require any specific equipment. It will cut with a standard grassland mower. You can buy more advanced machinery to cut at various heights, at sort of 1 meter intervals on the vertical axis to put the hemp into smaller lengths for decortication. But it's mown into a swath. It can be tedded out and put back into the swath. But the important part is that it has to ret in the windrow for about 4 to 6 weeks. And that's perhaps one of the issues in the Scottish climate, that would perhaps give some people some cause for concern. You know, what's the weather going to be like in September, October with the hemp on the ground? And the reason it's left on the ground for 4 to 6 weeks is so that the soil microbes are allowed to sort of naturally break down the chemical bonds that hold together the fibers such that it decorticates better. So on the premise that you don't lose the crop through inclement weather, it then gets baled up conventionally. So the advantage from a farmer's perspective is that it can be, you know, grown and harvested with a conventional equipment that's probably already on the farm or easy for it to get a contractor in to do. So, I mean, it's not a legume. It doesn't fix nitrogen. So from that point of view, it's not a break crop, but it will give a break to other pests and diseases that you'll probably find within the conventional rotations with cereals and all seed rape, for example.
It definitely is unusual leaving it lying for 4 to 6 weeks, but when you explain why it's done, you can completely understand why that happens. What other challenges do farmers face with growing the crop?
One of the problems is the ability to site hemp on a range of fields, and those fields' proximity to public access and visibility. An application needs to be made around February, March time to register yourself as an interested party with the Home Office, and then they will consider the license. Because most of the seed is imported, there are minimum import volumes that are required in able to import that seed. So I would imagine there would have to be some collaborative effort to import varieties of choice from abroad to bring costs down. Apart from a relatively low dose of nitrogen, about 100 kgs of N per hectare seems to be about the ballpark figure that people talk about in a normal soil indices situation. Pesticides and insecticides aren't really, well, I should say fungicides and insecticides aren't really, don't seem to be required. Obviously, I think storage is quite important. The hemp needs to go to the decortication plant, probably no more than 16 or 17% moisture. So it's not the sort of thing that you can stack up outside and leave to the elements. So there is a cost involved in looking after the crop post-harvest.
Yeah, which will be a challenge if you've had a particularly wet 6 weeks when you're waiting before you can bale it all up as well.
Yeah, definitely. Typically, you might budget for sort of 5 or 6 tons a hectare of hemp as a saleable volume. And again, the pricing that the farmer gets is very much dependent on the added value down the supply chain. And given the risks involved, i.e. with a new crop, and the fact that the harvesting and the retting period is an exposed risk, you would have to think that it's probably at least got to return a better margin than any other spring-grown crop for it to be considered. But time will tell, and I'm sure the outcomes of the Hemp 30 project will be looking at this. And I know NIAB are involved in running variety trials in England, so there's a big collective effort going on looking at all aspects of the economics and the profitability of the crop.
It's definitely great to hear about hemp, and I just get the feeling that it's not something you should be diving into right now unless a market opens up. I think it'd be very important to make sure there's a market for you there and then move into it then. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next few years as there's more information about it and more research on it as well.
Yeah, I'm sure it's an evolving picture with regard to the climate change agenda and the wish to reduce emissions in Scotland. Hemp, you know, is one of those solutions, I think, and it's from that perspective, it's a win-win crop. It it sequesters a ton and a half of CO2 for every ton of hemp grown. So I think from that perspective, there's a lot of incentive for the government to perhaps support this as a new novel crop.
I definitely think this is a case of watch this space. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mark.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be joined by Ian Biddle. Ian, would you like to start by introducing yourself?
Yes, my name's Ian Riddle and I work on a part-time basis as a principal consultant with SEC Consulting.
So we're going to be talking about sugar beet. This, whilst the other crops we've talked about in this episode are very much new crops, I feel like this is more of a historic crop which is coming forward potentially for a new generation to be growing. So Ian, why are people beginning to consider growing sugar beet again in Scotland?
Well, that's an interesting question. People are interested in growing sugar beet primarily because it is a crop with huge potential. It's got a very high dry matter, the highest dry matter yield of any crop, and a big sugar yield. So it could be grown. Originally, the intention was to grow it for bioethanol, but that market's not worth a lot. So we're now looking at growing the crop for the creation of bioplastics. And fortunately, we've been in touch with companies at Grangemouth who are interested in doing this, using the crop to develop bioplastics polyethylene products.
That sounds like something that's quite unique. I'm assuming it's because we're looking to be moving away from using fossil fuels.
That's correct, because the big attraction for them, the companies there, they use a lot of power and they are very keen to reduce their carbon footprint. And it's interesting that by using sugar beet, which sequesters 2 tons of CO2 equivalent in the process of making the polyethylene, you save 2 tons by sequestering, and you also save another 2 tons by not using fossil fuel and cracking fossil fuel to make your ethylene and polyethylene. So there is a net saving of 4 tons equivalent of CO2. So obviously that's a big appeal. And also there's an appeal in using Scottish product and a low carbon product to make your plastic.
It definitely does sound like it's ticking all the boxes when it comes to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So when they're producing polyethylene, is there any other byproducts that they're producing as well?
There may be in the chemical side, but the other byproduct you've got is probably more for the agricultural side, because when you convert sugar beet into ethanol, you actually cut it into small chips and you cook it and you separate the liquid, which becomes a syrup, which you turn into a concentrated sugar syrup, but you're left with all the fiber. And that could be sugar beet pulp or it could be used for some other uses as well.
Interesting. So just thinking about if farmers were to grow it, firstly, have you heard of anyone growing it yet or is the project not at that stage?
The project's at an early stage, but we have a number of farmers in Scotland who are already growing sugar beet varieties for their AD plants. They grow fodder, well, they call it energy beet. So there's fodder beet and sugar beet varieties, which are higher in sugar. So we know that there are at least 5 people who have been growing it for a number of years, one of which is Gordon Cairns at Strathcathra Estates. I just visited the other day. They've been growing it for, I think, 7 or 8 years. And getting regular tonnages of 65 tonnes per hectare. And over that period, fortunately, they haven't suffered any problems from frost or the sort of thing that could go wrong with a winter harvested crop. So that's been quite successful and it's been grown in different types of soils in different parts of Scotland. But it has to be grown in the best soils. So that's the most important thing.
Well, it's good to hear that if someone's been growing it for 7 or 8 years, they've obviously found that it is successful, because you would be put off quite quickly trying something new if it kept failing. So it's good to hear. So when you're thinking about the rotation, how often in the rotation could you be growing sugar beet?
Well, technically, in the literature, it says you could grow it once every 3 years, but I think to be safer, it's best to grow it in a 1-in-6 rotation. So it then becomes a question of which crop does it displace? So it could be your break crop. It could displace oilseed rape. It could displace potato or carrot crops or vegetable crops. It could even displace cereal crops. The other consideration there is, what do you grow after it? Because in a break crop, most people would want to get winter wheat in after a break crop. With sugar beet, you might be able to get your winter wheat in for early harvest crops. You know, you can harvest from October onwards, but you're harvesting right through until April. So there are later crops that could probably only be finished or followed by a spring cereal. So I think the important thing for farmers to look at is, you know, once we get information on you know, the price and the value of it, and we've done calculations on this, is to see, you know, what the value is over the whole rotation, what the profitability of the whole rotation is, and look at it that way. But the comment we've had from farmers at focus groups we held early on this year was that they are very keen to get a new break crop, you know, and some of them identified crops they probably would replace at that time. But it's all down to money. It's all down to the economics. You know, it's down to the price of the crop, the fertilizer, all these sort of things put together.
Yeah, you definitely have to think about the money aspect in it as well. Just so I get this clear in my head, so you're harvesting it all the way through till April. So when are you sowing the crop to begin with?
You have to sow the crop relatively late. So people tend to start sowing the crop in mid-May. And the reason for that is because it can be susceptible to frost, a late frost after sowing, which would encourage bolting. So you get bolting and you don't get much of a root at the bottom. So you want to avoid that. So people tend to sow from mid-April to late May is the normal sowing season. It's actually quite a slow growing crop initially. So you do, you know, weed competition can be quite bad. So you have to use at least 3 or 4 herbicides. But once it gets going and gets to autumn time, it really swells up quickly and it continues growing throughout the winter. So a September or October harvested crop might not yield as much as a January or February harvested crop.
That's quite interesting that it can keep growing throughout the winter. So you're saying that when it gets established, it's not very competitive against the weeds and you're needing herbicides. Is there a range of herbicides that can be used on sugar beet, or is it quite limited?
I think that's the answer. There is a range of crops that it is herbicides. They are limited, but we've still got them available. And obviously that would be a concern if some of these herbicides weren't available in future. So I know there is some research work into using mechanical weeding systems to see if that could be introduced, but that's not commercially available yet.
So what are the benefits of including sugar beet into your rotation other than having it as a potentially a break crop?
It's a cleaning crop once you've got the, you know, the shaws established. It's high margin would be the main thing, I would say. It's a break crop, so it's a break from disease like any other break crop, you know, for cereals. And I think the answer is actually it's a standalone high gross margin would be the thing for me.
It'll be interesting to see if some of these companies do get it up and running to be making the bioplastics from it, what prices they are offering to the farmers as well in the long run. So what are the challenges growing sugar beet in the rotation?
The challenge growing sugar beet, number one would be, I've already mentioned the frost and bolting risk at the front end of it after you've sown it. Once you've put in the herbicides and a couple of fungicides, that's the crop pretty well there. You can shut the gate and just leave it to grow. The next issue you've got is you have to harvest it between October and April, or even September and April, because you want as long a season as possible. Harvesting conditions aren't ideal all the way through winter. So for the AD plants, they've been able to pick and choose the time they can harvest. The biggest challenge will be if we're producing a big hectareage and, you know, initially a figure of 17,000 hectares was described, which is massive. you would have to be harvesting most days throughout the winter, or a lot of days throughout the winter with only a few breaks. And that might be more of a challenge. From a farmer's perspective, there's concern as to what machinery might do to soil structure and, you know, what kind of state the soil will be left in after harvest. And we are intending to monitor, you know, do some trials and monitor crops this winter just to see how this goes and assess the number of harvestable days. In theory, it should be okay, but you just can't tell with weather conditions. However, I mentioned earlier on, it has to be in the best land. If you have it on the, you know, what I would call prime agricultural land, land class 3.1, land class 2, class 1, limited amount of that as well, that will be a little bit better drained than other soils. So if you've got that and you've got equipment with big flotation tyres, it's not so bad. And the harvesting equipment, all the you know, harvestings we've viewed or videos we've seen shows that it doesn't look that damaging to soil. Not as bad as potato crops, where you're going a little bit deeper.
It's good to hear, though, that you're going to be doing further research on some of these factors to see what the impact is, because that'll help settle farmers' minds if it does go ahead and 17,000 hectares does go into sugar beet. It'll give everyone a bit more confidence because they know there's the research and studies behind it.
Yeah. There are a number of things to look at. And we've held these meetings with farmers and we know their questions. We know the kind of things they want to look at. From a farmer's perspective, the biggest thing is it's a new crop. It's not a new crop because it was grown between 1926 and 1972 or 74. So it has been grown in Scotland. Some people remember their father's or their grandfather's generation. And some of these guys said that they still miss sugar beet. So it has been growing before, but it's the only way we'll persuade a lot of people to grow the crop is by offering a good price. So we're being fairly realistic about that from the start. And some of the discussion back with some of the tiny growers was it'd need to be a price of £50 per tonne for the sugar beet. A few years ago, sugar beet for sugar in England was worth only £20-25 a tonne, but it's now up to about £40. So, you know, the price has gone up there and we would have to offer a high price or people are just not going to change because there's the knowledge that it has to be better than anything else that's currently in the rotation, and B, there's a risk factor as well. You know, what would happen if there was a frost and some of the crop was lost?
Yeah, I think the risk factor in Scotland is probably a lot bigger than it is in England because we definitely do have slightly harsher winters, although they have been a bit easier for the last few years. So see if that trend continues, it might make growing it easier in Scotland.
Yeah, might be easier and wetter. We just don't know. It was quite a dry January to March this year. So we will just have to see. But it's very important that we do some trials and monitoring the people who are already growing it over the next few years and hold demos like we are about to hold a demo fairly soon, a demo day to let people see the harvester in action and see what the soil's like. So it's important we do that so that farmers can see what it involves.
It sounds very interesting. So if they go ahead with using sugar beet to make bioplastics, what sort of timescale could we be looking at for getting to that point? As I'm sure there's lots of studies and feasibility studies and research needing to happen beforehand.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's probably, even if things go well, it's probably quite a while off because first thing that would need to happen is the chemical companies would need to do a feasibility study in some detail. And that would involve a feasibility study in the agriculture side to see the interest of farmers. We've already done a little bit of work on setting up a co-op and what that would involve for the farmers. Then there would be a design and build phase of the refinery, and that would take a few years. And then there's testing before it gets set up. So we would estimate it's probably at least 8 years until something can be set up and running. And working concurrently with that, there's the chemical side and there's the agricultural side, a co-op would need to be set up and members taken on board. It's a little bit chicken and egg. If we're going to supply huge tonnage, and it might not be 17,000 hectares, but a huge tonnage to the chemical company. We need commitment from the farmers, we need them on board. You need to buy all the equipment with maybe 2-year lead times for some of the specialist sugar beet equipment. So that would give us the time, but there's a lot of work needs to be done to get it off the ground and started.
It all sounds very interesting. I feel like it's a watch this space and just wait and see how it progresses going forward.
Yeah, very much so. There's a fair bit of work's going to go into it. And we have already had two feasibility studies done, and they both suggested that it's possible the crop can be grown here. We know that already. The farmers' enthusiasm is there. But it'll depend on having enough massive farmers wanting to do it. And to do that, we need to have contracts that are attractive to them. On one hand, you need a good price that's better than any other crop they've currently got. And the other, they need a bit of stability, a guaranteed price for a number of years.
That's very interesting. And it's great hearing all about it. Thank you, Ian. Thank you to our three fantastic speakers. It's been very interesting hearing about these alternative crops. Next up, we have the update from out in the field.
Hi, my name is Mark Basher-Gibbs, and I'm a consultant with SAC Consulting. As we are all very well aware, we're coming into a very much later period than usual for getting spring crops into the ground. And for the majority of growers, it'll be into April before ground conditions allow for any kind of field work and seedbed preparation. Spring beans will ideally have been sown in March, and there may be a few that have managed to get beans in the ground. And for crops like spring barley, spring wheat and oats, most crops will be sown through April, with the last to go in possibly as late as early May. In a late season like this, final yields will be influenced to a greater degree by the extent to which plants can tiller before moving into their reproductive growth stages. Soil moisture and good seed-to-soil contact is required for good germination. However, where soil is very wet, such as a season like this, oxygen becomes a limiting factor which can reduce germination. One way we can help mitigate the downsides of late sowing this year is to pay particular attention to seed rates, so we optimise the number of ears per metre squared come harvest. Of course, we know spring barley has a better capacity for tillering, while spring oats and spring wheat less so. When calculating seed rates through April, aim to establish 350 plants per metre squared for spring barley, 360 plants per metre squared for spring oats, and 380 plants per metre squared for spring wheat. Your final seed rate calculation should account for the seed's 1,000 grain weight, the germination percentage, and your expectations for establishment rate. As a general rule of thumb, increase seed rates by 50 seeds per metre squared from your original calculation for each week that sowing is delayed beyond the first week of April. This will help achieve target fertile tiller numbers through to harvest.
Thank you for joining us today, and thank you to our three fantastic speakers. If you've enjoyed this episode, please make sure you subscribe and follow our podcast so you're notified of future episodes. If you have enjoyed this podcast, why not try listening to one of the other Farm Advisory Service podcasts? There is a range of podcasts, including Stock Talk, Rural Roundup, Thrill of the Hill, and Agriculture, as well as others. They're definitely worth a listen. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next time.
The Farm Advisory Service Podcast. Audio advice on livestock, crops and soils, environment, rural business, and more. Brought to you in association with the Scottish Government.